Well, we've come so quickly to the last morning talk of this 9-day retreat. If you don't count the seconds and the minutes and the hours, the days disappear. It just seems like just a moment ago we just sat here to start this retreat. A person who lives in the present moment, just time doesn't have much meaning for them. And that's why that sometimes the idea of like beginnings of a retreat and the end of the retreat, middle of the retreat, it's all like what we call conventional reality. But really the practice of meditation will and must always continue on. It's what happens, you can't resist it. As somebody said the other day, and I really appreciate that, that when one gets into a calm, peaceful state of mind, one has what the Buddha called a taste of freedom, and that taste of freedom was used as a title of one of Ajahn Chah's books. It's a very evocative title because it means that for many, actually not years, but lifetimes, we've been seeking for a freedom, for a peace, for an inner happiness. And many, many times we get close, but we don't really get there. We find that the path which we are pursuing for fulfillment, to peace, for freedom, never really reaches the end which it promised. We come down many, many blind alleys, many dead-end streets in our spiritual life. But then, now and again, we actually come across something which is pure, meaningful, and true. This is what we call that taste of freedom. And that taste of freedom, if you can really experience that, is something which is worth more than any jewels or gold in the world. It's one of the Buddha's sayings, that the experience of stream winning is just so valuable, so worthwhile, but all the king's jewelry could not sort of match. So the experience of a stream winning, of seeing the Dhamma, and even just having a glimpse of what the Dhamma might be like by achieving a deep state of meditation and peace, it's one of the most valuable, or rather invaluable, pieces of experience you could possibly have. At the end of your life, before you die, when you look back and think of all the things which you have done, all the experiences you've been through, those states of deep meditation are the ones which is the most profound. Even all the great talks you've been through, all the inspiring things you've achieved, just the achievement of peace is at the pinnacle, the peak of all those experiences. That's why the taste of freedom is so paramount. Which is another reason why, you know, on this retreat, as all the retreats I've been teaching for the last few years, I have marketed the jhanas. I know that last night in the question time that people were quite rightly pointing out some of the dangers of talking so much about jhanas. It gives one sort of the idea that if you don't get the jhanas, you're a loser, that you've wasted your retreat. And sometimes the idea of a goal and aspiration leads people to frustration. They try so hard, and then they don't get it, and they end up saying, well, it's just I can't do it. Or they ask questions like, how many people in this retreat got those jhanas? Now, I'd like to really say that, because sometimes in the interviews that people tell me they're nice meditations, but there's something about the interviews which are very private. I mean, I have to say that people have great meditation on these retreats. They do get results. That's as far as I would say. And that really inspires me as a teacher to know that what you're teaching is actually doing something, it's working. That when you do encourage people for these states, that some of them do achieve them. And those who don't achieve them, the very fact that you're pushing people higher, what we call raising the bar, means that people actually are aspiring, they're reaching, and they're stretching much further than they possibly would do if we said, don't even bother with jhanas, and don't even mention it. If like some other monks, even forest monks, say that it's hopeless, lay people can't get jhanas. If I thought that, then of course I wouldn't teach this way, and then the community would not appreciate these things, and then the lay community would not really understand just what motivates many monks and nuns. They wouldn't get to the heart of the Sangha which they support or which they're part of, and they wouldn't appreciate just how powerful and deep these Buddhist teachings are. One of the experiences of jhana which I never mentioned, it's called in Pali ekagata. Sometimes it's called like one-pointedness of mind. However, that word, again, is a translation which was makeshift, which doesn't really convey the full meaning of that factor of the all the jhanas. Because the word agga is like a peak, like a mountain peak. It's like an acme, it's a summit. It's not just the one point, any old point. It's a very high and lofty and sublime point. And many people, even though you may not know Pali or Sanskrit, when I tell you the Sanskrit equivalent to agga, you'll recognize it straight away. It's called Agra. And many of you have been to Agra, the Mughal capital of India, in where lies the Taj Mahal and the Red Fort and all these other old monuments. The reason why the Mughal emperors of India called their capital Agra, because it was a peak, it was a summit. A capital is like a high coming together of one thing. And this is what ekagata means. It means the mind coming together in one sublime summit of experience. Not just an ordinary point, but a very high point. And it's in that summit of experience where everything sort of comes together. The proverbial summit of the mountain where all the paths meet together in one point. That always gives you this beautiful sense of non-duality. And in fact, that word non-duality only has a meaning, experiential meaning, in the experiences of ekagata, of the jhanas and above. There the mind does not discriminate. It cannot, it's too frozen solid to do so. It's still. And this is another example of how those experiences, they illuminate the philosophy which you have, the belief system which you have. They make it clear. They fill in all the gaps. Because the philosophy, the theory, is like the proverbial menu. It's not the food, but you need the menu to find the food. You need all these talks, all these theories, all these discussions in order to get you close. But the final part of the journey has to be the leap into the deep meditations. One of the great similes which the Buddha gave came from one of the last teachings which he gave. But even though it was late in the Buddha's life, it appears number two in the first collections of teachings called the Digha Nikaya. This is the Samanyapala Sutta. And the metaphor comes from the real experience of the new king, Ajatasattu, who went to go and see the Buddha. He was living in Rajagaha, and the Buddha was just in a bamboo grove, which was not that far away. For those of you who've been to the holy sites in India, you know, you've been to the bamboo grove, you can get some idea where the center of town was. It's not that far. But King Ajatasattu, it was a full moon night, he wanted to go and see some holy people, and it was actually the first time he really became interested in what the Buddha had to say. And he went to the bamboo grove in his chariot, as far as chariots can go. And then he had to get out of his chariot and walk as far as walking could go. It was actually on that way that because he was walking and it was dark, even though it was moonlit, it was dark, he got very afraid and wondered whether this was some sort of trap, whether his enemies were going to attack him, because kings are always afraid. But he went by feet as far as he could go, and then before he came into the hall to see the Buddha, he had to take his shoes off to actually enter the hall. And that's a wonderful simile how we have different vehicles at different parts of that spiritual practice. We can only go in a chariot as far as a chariot can go, then we can go by foot as far as feet can go, in other words by shoes, and then we have to take the shoes off to go into the hall where the Buddha lies. And this is a wonderful simile of just how our practice goes. Sometimes we can go in by theories and discussions as far as the theories can take us. And they can actually just, as it were, get you to the entrance of the monastery. The entrance of the abode of the Dhamma, of the truth. It only gets you to the entrance way. But to go into that entrance, you have to take your shoes off. Get down from your vehicles. To get down from some of your theories and beliefs and start walking through experience. In other words, in your own shoes, to walk your own little journey there. But then you get so close, and actually to enter the hall where the Buddha is, you've got to take off your sandals or your shoes to be able to enter inside. And that's where we take off the five senses and the will. We have to leave those outside, to enter where the Buddha lies, in the deep stillness. But the closer you get, the more of a taste, a smell, an inclination that you're on the right path. And it's because of that that you always want to encourage people with these jhanas. To go back to that simile, that there are as many vehicles even for the practice of meditation. You know, you start with just body awareness. That can be a rough vehicle. And then you go to the breath. And you take the breath as far as the breath can go. And then you use a nimitta, and you go to nimitta as far as the nimitta can go. And then, to actually enter the hall of the jhanas, you even have to leave the nimitta outside and just enter that great stillness. So because this is an experiential path, I've encouraged you to have the deepest of experiences on this retreat. But please, never get frustrated. The goals are there, and the goals do not necessarily lead to frustration. It's the wrong attitudes lead to frustration, not the presence of goals. The wrong attitude is either impatience, which is wanting it now, this retreat. I've only got another few hours, come on, gimme, gimme, gimme. And that impatience is one of the greatest hindrances to our achievements in meditation. We have to be very, very patient when we have the goals. And the other bad attitude which we have when we have goals is actually to have the idea that just wanting the goal is enough without investigating and creating the causes. And I mention this because sometimes if we don't have goals at all in our meditation, if we just say that anything goes, then anything does go. We find that we just flounder around, go from one tradition to another tradition, one type of meditation to the other meditation, messing around this way, that way. But we haven't got any clear goals, then we have no direction in which to aim our practice. We do need targets. But the point is, how can we have a target, a goal, without allowing that frustration and that will and that striving to develop? And of course the answer is, you have that goal, you understand exactly what it is, but also you understand its causes. What is necessary? What do you have to do? What is your part in the achievement of those goals? And you should know by now, unless you've been asleep for the whole retreat, that the causes for these deep meditations are the letting go, the peace, the stillness, the renouncing of your interest in the world outside, and your letting go of this choosing, this will. That is the causes. And your job is always just to put these in place as much as you can. Be as diligent in maintaining the causes. That's as far as your effort goes. The effort of mindfulness, to keep that supervisor so you know what you're doing, so you know if you're messing around and starting interfering with the whole process of meditation. But if you know what those causes are, and mindfully, diligently, you make sure those causes are maintained, then it has only to be a matter of time, of patience, for those deep meditations to occur. And in all the retreats which I've led, that's been obvious to me, because people who keep on this path, who keep the instructions, who follow the instructions carefully, they do get these deep states of meditation. They do bliss out. They get that taste of freedom. And for those of you in the interviews who have came close enough or actually experienced it, you know what it's like and just how powerful and meaningful that is. And it's worth thousands of retreats, hundreds of retreats, to get those experiences. It's in the experience which we fully understand this Dhamma. Not in the words, not in the books, but in the actual experience of it. Which is why I remember that documentary I mentioned the other night called The Mindful Way, done by the BBC about 2 or 3 years before Ajahn Chah got sick, when he was still teaching. I remember him talking, actually no, this was the Buddha Comes to Sussex a little while afterwards, when he visited England, and he gave a little simile for the camera about the apple. He said, you know, in Thailand, when apples were very, very rare, they were an exotic fruit for Thailand for many years, And he said, you know, because it was exotic and very famous in the West, when you could get an apple in Thailand, it would cost a lot of money. And so it was a delicacy. And so he said, all these Thai people, they want to know what an apple tastes like. The only way you can know what an apple tastes like is to bite into it, and then you know. And he used that as a simile of the Dharma. You can read all the books on apples, but you'll never know what an apple tastes like. You can read all the books about Dharma, and still you don't know what the Dharma tastes like. It's only when you bite into that apple that then you'll know what it tastes like. And it's only in the experience that we lose all of this Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, even Buddhism, Christian, this way or that way, Vipassana, Samatha, all these other debates. They all disappear in the truth and reality of an experience, a personal experience, which is why we practice in this way. So you can taste it, and it's possible for you to taste it. And even if you find it difficult to taste it, really there's no other option. The only real way to understand this Dharma is to experience it. So basically, it doesn't matter how long it takes. It doesn't matter how many retreats it takes you to do this. You've got no choice. You have to keep on going until you taste that Dharma. If not this life, the next life. If not the next life, 10 lives, 100 lives, who cares? It's the only thing which is really worthwhile if you really want to understand what is going on with life. And people who do have those experiences of the deep meditation, which you do eventually, since everybody does eventually, just a matter of time, is persisting and never giving up, and just using wisdom as well, making sure if it's not working, why is it not working? I remember that one of the great powers is this thing called vimamsa, which is investigation. It's one of these idipadas, these roads to success. And what this means is whenever you get to an obstacle, don't keep banging your head against the brick wall. Don't try and sort of force your way through it, which is what many people do. And I'm stronger than the brick wall, and you keep barging it, butting your head until you get sore and bruised. Because what you do whenever you come to an obstacle in life, or an obstacle in meditation especially, is you stand back and you look. What I've always found in my practice of meditation, or even in my spiritual life, or even the worldly life, whenever a problem comes up, you know, whether it's in a conference or a meditation center or Buddhist society, instead of bashing through it, which is like the macho stupid way to do it, what you usually do is just stand back. And I found with every brick wall, if you look a little bit to the left, there's a gateway, there's a doorway through, and on the right there's a ladder going over. It's just when you look at the brick wall right in front of you, you can't see what's to the left or right, above or below, and you keep banging into this brick wall. I remember watching the news once, and there was one of these detention centres for, I think, the Indonesian refugees or whatever it was, which Mr. Howard tried to stop or did stop. And they had the big wall there, the big fence. And when they had the shot on the TV, it said, this big, tall fence. But because of the lack of finances in the immigration department, this big barbed wire fence, which was very tall and very thick, only lasted about 20 metres either side of the gateway. So anyone just needs to walk around it. They couldn't finish it. And I thought it was a wonderful metaphor for the obstacles which we face in life. Well, these big brick walls are, that's all you can see is a brick wall, that's in your field of vision. But look back, and it only goes a little way that way, a little way that way. Just walk off the beaten track. Stop all your conditioned reactions. Don't do it in the same old way you've always done it. Be resourceful, be intuitive, be fresh, look at different ways of doing things. And then you find that brick wall, that obstacle in your life, in your meditation, in your spiritual journey, you find, just stand back a bit and you see a beautiful way around. And it is so easy. Success is easy. It is the failures is the difficult part. And it's only difficult because you make it difficult. That's why that really there is no success and failure, all that measuring business. If you've had a difficult time in this retreat, it is just dung for your mango tree. And if you've had a wonderful retreat this time, it is because the last few retreats had a lot of dung, and now they've actually turned into fertilizer, and now you've got your beautiful tasting mango. So those of you who had a very difficult retreat, great, more fertilizer, when this mango tree of mine does eventually fruit, wow, I've got so much dung and shit in my life. This is going to be a beautiful mango. It's going to be really tasty more than anyone else's. So the point is, with that positive attitude, nothing is lost. There is no frustration. Because whatever happens is par for the course. I've noticed that if you have an easy way to nirvana, if you find the freeway and just go straight to the destination, sure, you get there quickly and you have a wonderful time. But if you get lost by taking the wrong off ramps and going off here and off there and going on detours, sure, it takes you a lot of time, but you know so much about the territory. When someone else makes a mistake, yeah, I've been down there as well. When someone does something stupid, yeah, I went down that way. So if you have had a difficult time, you are going to be a great teacher. So in other words, whatever happens, it's all grist for the mill. It's all very useful. So setting goals gives you direction. And it's only the wrong attitude causes the frustration. And the frustration tends to make you give up. People who achieve never give up, because there's nothing else worth doing. Once you get a taste of real freedom, of real peace, you notice how true that is. Once you have a taste, and you know the causes for that taste, you recreate those conditions, and you keep going forward. And only then will we have lots more Aryas in this world, lots more stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and arahats. It would be wonderful if there was an easier way. A way where you didn't need to actually to practice this meditation, or you didn't need to listen to all these talks, or didn't need to keep the 8 precepts. If you could go to the pub, have as much sex as you want, see all the movies, be sort of indulgent, and I could just give you the enlightenment pill. And just take one pill in your lifetime and get enlightenment out of the way and then carry on enjoying yourself. Or even better, maybe just at the end of your life, just before you die, so you can be completely indulgent or whatever you want, but the last moment of your life I give you the enlightenment pill, so just you can get it right at the very end after you've wasted your whole life, so you can just get enlightenment. That point is, that's not possible. I know that there was this, people told me this was Tibetan retreat many years ago, and at the end of the retreat they were giving out enlightenment pills. Unfortunately, I think that's what the Westerners thought they were. They weren't enlightenment pills, but they got the name enlightenment pill. So at the end of the retreat, you got the enlightenment pill. However, that does not work. It has to be coming from within. And so that we practice on this retreat, and we get experiences, and we get some taste, we get some glimpse. And that's the whole reason why we do this. And those of you who think you've got nowhere on this retreat, or you think you haven't got as far as you expected, one of the great insights which you will have soon is when you leave this place later on this afternoon. One of the very first retreats which I did, it was when I left the place to go back to London. I just couldn't believe just how fast people moved and how loud they talked. Just the whole world was just like this screeching cacophony of nonsense. And it's only then I realized, just in the days I'd been on this retreat, I'd slow down and become quiet. But because everyone else has slowed down and become quiet, I'd never noticed my progress. It was only when I had some perspective, when I went outside. It's like traveling in a train with the shutters down. Sometimes you don't know how fast you're traveling. Or being an aircraft, even better simile. You can't feel the movement of the plane because it's cruising. Many, many kilometers and miles are passing you by, and you don't realize it. On a retreat such as this, when you go out afterwards, sometimes it's just you shudder at just how harsh the world is outside this retreat, little oasis. And one of the reasons why I say this afternoon, if you're driving a car back home, don't go into the main road straight away. Just drive around the car park, up and down the side streets, until you get used again to actually to reacting fast. Otherwise, a car will come up to you and you'll say, "Don't do anything, no doing, let go, let go." Then you may have an accident or something. It's true, you get so cool and so still. You go to another world sometimes. And this is okay, this retreat, but when you go outside, you've got to be a bit faster, especially if you go to the airport and you're going back to Malaysia or Singapore and they say the last boarding call with this anti-monk skill, go, and then you're just going right foot moving, going forward, going down, left foot moving, going forward. You never make it. There's great fun just to see just how still and peaceful you have become. I know that very funny story about walking meditation, which happened in the first years of our monasteries in England. Because the first monastery was at Chithurst in the south of England in Sussex. And they wanted to hold a meditation retreat, but it was only an old house and they were renovating it. And if you have like people coming into a monastery, where are the monks going to stay? All the monks were sort of sleeping 2, 3, 4 to a room, so there's no space for anybody else. But they were very fortunate because there was one of their disciples, she was like a clinical psychiatrist. Psychiatrists and psychologists, they gravitate towards things like Buddhism because there's so much Dharma which they can use in their job. So this clinical psychiatrist, she had this big old house sort of in one of the villages, you know, close by, you know, like Sussex villages, you know what English life is like. And so she offered her house, and it had like a bar in the back, like a meditation room, and they could very easily turn it into a nice little meditation retreat. So they had a lovely weekend there doing the sitting meditation and walking meditation, but they didn't have like a retreat like this. It was all organized. This time you get up, this time you sit, this time you walk. And when it came to walking meditation, all these people, they went in the gardens where you usually go, and they're walking very, very slowly, just watching their feet move up and going forward and going down, with their eyes just glazed 2 meters in front of them, so slowly. Now the people in the village, they know everything about who does what and where, and they knew that this lady was a clinical psychiatrist who worked at the local mental hospital. And when they saw all these crazy zombies walking forward, one of them called the police to complain that her patients were all living in her home. And the police arrived to try and gather up all the inmates from the mental home and take them back again. And how to explain, these weren't inmates from the mental home, these were meditators, because these were Buddhists. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. So that's why we have these retreat centres with big walls, because people looked over the fence and saw what you were doing. Every time I hear these sirens going, I think, oh, has this happened? Are they coming to collect somebody from my retreat? So you do actually change when you come on these retreats. You do become peaceful. And one of the other nice things about when you become peaceful, just on a tangent here, have you ever noticed when people become peaceful, they laugh very easily? It's amazing just how much people laugh at the most silly things I say. And it's because you get light-hearted and you get sort of peaceful and still, and you manage to laugh more. The more a person is still, the more they can laugh and become happy. It's just that when you meditate, a general level of happiness goes up. And sometimes you don't realize that again, because everyone's level of happiness and peace has risen. And you find that sometimes after meditation you get the giggles. That's a very standard stage of meditation, the giggle stage. And it's just because your mind is nice and happy and light. And this is one of the best benefits of the meditation. Sure, you get the taste of freedom, but also you get the taste of happiness. Real happiness, where you don't need alcohol, you don't need drugs. It's very often that people are looked upon the monks and they're thinking, my goodness, what are these monks taking? There must be some drug they're on. And on one of these occasions I was in England, and one of my friends there, he was working in the prisons, and they started this Buddha Grove project, where they managed to talk the Home Office, who ran the prisons in the UK, into putting these big Buddha statues in the gardens of the prisons and landscaping around that, making it a quiet area, a peaceful area. And with a bit of help from some supporters in high places, they managed to get this through the Home Office. And when they had this first Buddha Grove in Springhill Prison, over in middle of England somewhere, had this wonderful, beautiful Buddha statue, and a big one, donated by the Thais. And a few of the prisoners had landscaped around it. It was a quiet area where the prisoners could actually contemplate and be still and just get their act together. And so psychologically, it was really, really powerful. When I had the first opening, they wanted a ceremony for it, and I just happened to be in town at the time, so I was invited to that ceremony. And what do we do at Buddhist ceremonies? We do this circumambulation with candles and flowers and incense. So, you know, I was into that. I'd circumambulate anything. I'd circumambulate a cup of tea if you gave me a nice one. So, there I was circumambulating this Buddha shrine. And I was getting really high because this was inspiring. And in like a prison where these guys, you know, again, they're not prisoners, they're people who've done a crime. They're not criminals, they're people. And you know, you wanted to do something for them, and just having like a Buddha statue in an English prison, it was amazing that that could happen. Now, when I was a young Buddhist, you know, just going to Buddhist clubs in university, that was just, you know, inconceivable that that could happen. But now there it was, this big Buddha statue, and we did it in the evening just when sort of dusk came down, and it had all this beautiful aroma of the incense wafting around and the candles, and you were circumambulating, the Buddha there was lit up and it was golden and brilliant, and we're doing this in the prison where, you know, people really needed some metta and some freedom, and I just got so happy and high. I was just big smile. And as I was going around, like in these occasions, there's some of the prisoners that are really into it, and others are just really bored, but they're going to see what's going on, what's happening, it's really boring in the prison. So a couple of these prisoners in their greens were just standing around, just looking. One of them saw me smiling, and I heard him, and he turned around to his friend and said, "He's on the gear." He's a druggie, because that's the only way they could think you could get a big smile like that. They recognise that, they, you know, really, really happy smile from whenever they were on these big drugs. So they thought I was on the key. And it's true that, you know, if you're sort of a meditator like this, you're so happy, you go outside, people think you have been taking something in this retreat. You know, what are you on? What did Bianca put in the curry? But, you know, they put nothing in the curry. It's just when you get really peace and still, you get happy. And it doesn't matter how you think your meditation has progressed, you've done really well or not so well, you'll notice your happiness level has gone up. The meter has gone off. And for some of you, it's gone off the scale. You're going to have to get a new meter. Your idea of what happiness is. And this is what I really love about those experiences of deep peace. Because then your scales of happiness, they really go up to the meter. And then you get happiness better than sex. Drugs, that's nothing compared to jhanas. You really get into the big stuff, the big ecstasy, the really huge blisses. And that's wonderful to give people that joy. Because that really encourages other people. They see these smiles on these people's faces. Peaceful, beautiful, radiant smiles. Which comes from the beautiful, peaceful, radiant mind. And you understand what in that second sutta the Buddha actually said, the fruits of the holy life. When people ask you, why did you come to this retreat? You should never say to get jhana. You should never say to get enlightened. You came here for happiness. And they'll understand that. Happiness upon happiness upon happiness. Because this is what the King Ajatasattu asked the Buddha, he said, what are you doing this for? Why are you all guys being monks? There's some really young guys over here. They've got rich parents. They could be enjoying themselves like I'm enjoying myself. What the heck have you all done spending your Easter weekend sitting on a cushion all day? And why are some of you who've got very busy jobs, you come all the way from New Zealand or from Singapore or Malaysia, why can you have gone to some big resort somewhere and sort of enjoyed yourself with discos, or going to China and walked on the Great Wall of China, or just get alive? So some people can't understand what you're doing here. But when you actually say you do this for happiness, and they look at you, and my goodness, you are happy. Then that is one of the powerful Dharma teachings, one of the strongest. They find that if you do some meditation, you become a happier, more peaceful person. And if you really get into it, you really get happy. And that's exactly what the Buddha told Ajatasattu, the king. He said, what's the fruits of the holy life, of being a monk, or being a meditator, or being a Buddhist? What do you get out of it? People want to know that. He started saying, listen, great king, even when you start keeping precepts, when you keep a virtuous lifestyle, you stop harming other people or harming beings, your happiness level just rises. It's just like the ocean when the tide rises. Sure, you get the same waves, but the troughs of the waves now are higher than the peaks when the tide was low. Even your worst moments become much more pleasurable than the high moments years ago when you weren't practicing precepts. Your average level of happiness starts to increase. Sometimes it's hard for you to notice that, but other people surely do. People will notice a change when you go back home. They will like the effect this meditation has on you. They will see that. They will see that you are softer, happier, more joyful, more cuddly. And the point is that this is a valid fruit. This is why you're doing this. You are happier. And if you get into samadhi, you really get into big happiness. And if you get enlightenment, that's the ultimate happiness. But all the way is happiness upon happiness upon happiness. When I really understood that with teachers like Ajahn Chah, who were constantly happy, always so easy to laugh at the most stupid of things. When you started seeing that, you understood just how this path is something I wanted to follow, a path of ever increasing happiness. And understanding that, all the severity of like hard meditation or blasting people with the idea, you're not sitting properly, you're not paying attention, you weren't up early this morning, all that sort of type of teachings does not make any sense at all to me. That's not part of the path. That's not the part of the path to happiness. You get more encouragement, you get more out of people. So when you encourage them, you make them happy, and you say, this is even greater happiness coming. It is the carrot which we always use in Buddhism, not the stick. It's beautiful not to have a religion or a path which runs on fear, which runs on the promise of punishment, which says, if you don't go to the Buddhist fellowship every week, if you don't return your books to the Buddhist society, we've got the librarians here, you've heard of Apple, you will go to hell, you're making bad karma. We don't do things like that. Instead, we just encourage people with a path of happiness and peace. And you get much more out of a person that way. Some of you have come into your interviews, and some of you said, oh, I've been thinking all over the place. Have you noticed when you come to the interviews and you tell me your problems, I always say, oh, that's really good. How many of you have gone to the interviews and you say, you stupid meditator, I don't know why I bother with you. Why don't you just go home and stop bothering me? You always get encouragement, even though sometimes I have to bite my lip and say, that's very, very good. Simply because that is the way you get greater happiness. That's where you get peace. So the way I've been encouraging you in those interviews which I've given you and in these talks, please encourage yourself in the same way. Praise everything you've done on this retreat. All the beautiful meditations, all the times when you've really decided, I'm going to sit meditation, I'm going to do something rather than just sleeping, or I'm going to really sort of, you know, try and watch my breath. Even the smallest of successes which you have, they are the eggs which you've laid on this retreat. Take them home with you. Any of the chicken shit, the times when you've been really stupid and dumb, leave that here on the retreat to rot. take back with you in your memory of this retreat only the beautiful eggs, so you can make an omelette for your family and you can sell some in the market afterwards for cash. You get the idea? So why is it that the end of things, where we collect the experiences of our week, why is it that some people only collect the faults and the things which went wrong? Why is it that people visit the gasworks instead of the gardens? So at least you've learned something in this retreat. Don't be someone who hangs out in the gasworks of life. Hang out in the gardens. It's up to you. You can if you wish. And so if you remember all the beautiful meditations you've had, all the good jokes, not the bad jokes, and all the wonderful sadhus, not the sort of half-hearted sadhus, and all the sonorous chanting rather than the out-of-tune chanting. If you remember all of that and you take that home with you, then you understand the key to happiness. We cannot control the world. Outside is just the way the world is. That person who was really complaining about the sound of the shower and the toilets, I'll tell you something, tomorrow morning when you wake up at home, you'll miss all of that. You'll be so nostalgic. It's true, because there's this, some of you know this lady, there was this, we call them like battle axes, this old Chinese Thai lady, and she was married to a Chinese man, and you know, puts up, and she would, whenever she'd come to our temple on a weekend, and she'd always be shouting at her husband, George, George, George. And, oh, it should, you know, if ever I thought of getting married, which I never have, that would have stopped me straight away. She was a tyrant. And I don't know how he could stand her. And every week he'd be embarrassed in public. You know, you remember. You know. And then she died. And as soon as she died, I thought, wow, that man has sigh of relief. At last, she's gone. But then after a couple of weeks, he came to talk to me and said, oh, I miss her so much. It was crazy. So whoever was complaining, you'll miss the sound of the showers and the sound of the toilet going early in the morning. All those happy memories will be gone. Which is the way we work. So the point is that we can get greater and greater happiness in this meditation. And we also learn just how to learn to live with life and make peace with it. You can't control the world. You can't control other people. Those of you married, you might be trying to control your husband, your wife, ever since you got married. You should give up by now, after this retreat anyway. And have a nice, peaceful life. And that way you understand that certainly, whatever happens to you in the world, if the plane is delayed, you can't control that. But at least you can make peace with it. Say, okay, I just enjoy myself. I can just go and do some meditation in the corner of the airport, have a cup of coffee or read a Dharma book or something. We don't need to get, why does this happen? It shouldn't happen. I'm going to be late. What's going to happen next? This is wrong. Why? You can't control the air company, but you certainly can control your mind. And that's just an example. Sometimes you can't control the sound or the pain in the body. Some of you had difficult pains in the body. We've had difficult experiences in life. Sometimes you can't control those. They just happen. People do die. Or you know, you lose your jobs, or you get bad backs, or whatever sicknesses you have. This is part of life. You can't really control that. It would be wonderful if you could and say, I wish my children didn't die. I wish my back never hurt. I wish I never had that accident to begin with. You can't control life. But you can control your attitude towards it. That's where you do have power. And the way we control our attitude towards these things, there's nothing you can do. Just do nothing. Make peace. And enjoy. This is what you learn in meditation. The same attitudes which work in meditation, you find start to work in life. You meditate. It's not a good meditation, so you think. Thinking all over the place, being restless, worrying. Leave it alone. You can't control the world, but at least you can control your attitudes to the restless mind or the slothful mind. That's what you can do. So you work and you know where to put your efforts, where to actually to do things, where you can be effective. Then you become highly effective in where it matters in your life. You can, where it's time to let go, you can just let go. Can't change the flight schedule? Leave it alone. When you can do something, you know where you can, because you know where to look. So what you learn in this meditation is not just the path to jhanas and enlightenment, you also know the path to happiness in life, which is why Buddhists, scientifically proven to be generally happier people, meditators, simply because you know how to train the mind. So what you've done on this retreat is something amazing, something beautiful. And you'll find people often ask, well, how should I continue when I'm back home? Sometimes you don't need to answer that question, because you'll find your answers yourself. Once you've got the incentive there, once you've got the force inside of you, now you will gravitate toward more meditation. Either going to other temples, ashrams, viharas, or wherever there's a meditation going on, you just go there. Or if you haven't got a temple close by to you, you can make one in your home. I always give people the advice at the end of a meditation retreat, how about turning one of the rooms in your house into a meditation room? Chuck everything out. Renounce. Clean it all up. And so you have this beautiful empty room, this empty space, just like the emptiness inside the heart of the lotus. You can call that your lotus room. Or if you haven't got a lotus room where you can actually have a little meditation space and have a corner of your bedroom, you can call that your lotus corner. And there, the only thing you ever do in that space is just either to meditate or to read some Dhamma book. I know that somebody told me that they've got a little room in their house which is their meditation room, but they've also got their computer in there. And that's very dangerous. But what you can do is sometimes what we do in our sort of temple, in our community centre, we've got a big Buddha statue in there. When there's some cultural events, you know, we actually close the curtains. It's like, you know, putting these eye shades over the Buddha so they can't see what's going on. So that's what you can do with your computer. You can actually put a cloth over it when you meditate, so it sort of disappears for a while. At least by putting that cloth over it, you're almost like letting it go during the period of the meditation. So if you are in a corner of the bedroom, anything which is, you think is going to be disturbing, cover it up. So that when you're in the corner of your bedroom, or in this little room, you can actually get the idea, this is my meditation space, this is my temple, this is my holy area, this is my sacred space. Once you start doing that, you find that that sacred space starts to develop its own energy. It becomes a peaceful, quiet place where you can hang out there. And some people have found, not only you, but even your kids hang out there. Even your dog comes and sits in meditation right next to you. Because the dogs, they don't know exactly what you're doing, but they certainly pick up you're being peaceful, and they resonate with that peace, and they just sit there. Or sometimes cats aren't so resonant. They usually get up on your lap and start licking you, or start licking themselves usually. But dogs are very good that way. So you've got a sacred place in your house. And when you've got a sacred place in the house, it means it's much easier to meditate when you've got a place which has got energy for meditation. And that's why we build the sacred corners in our house, or even in your office. You know how busy an office can be. There's always a cupboard somewhere, or a little corner. And you can tell your secretary that once I'm in that corner, no messages. And if anyone rings up, you don't get the answer, I'm sorry, she's in a conference. You say, I'm sorry, she's on a meditation cushion. That really impressed all the callers which call you up. Because you need that space, that quietness, to be able to work in this world. Without space, without quietness, without rest, you tend to become very inefficient. This is what I mentioned earlier. If you have to think a lot, if you're a business person, or if you're doing a PhD, or doing anything creative, or working hard, you need to have, like I used to have at school when I was in primary school, playtime. If you went to school and you did lesson after lesson without any break at all, do you think the children could concentrate and do well? No way. So in a primary school, we break up the lessons, maybe two lessons and have playtime. Another two lessons and more playtime. So for you, playtime is meditation time. It's recess, where you go to the recesses of your mind inside, the peaceful places. What the Buddha said, the cave of the heart, where it's nice and peaceful and quiet. And you've learned all these wonderful methods by remembering the most peaceful place you've ever been. For those of you who had a look, a peek inside my cave, so quiet and peaceful, you can just sit down and meditate in your office and just think, Ajahn Brahm's cave. And you're back there straight away. And you're meditating. It's so easy. So there's lots of tricks of the trade which I've taught you in this retreat. And those tricks of the trade, you don't need to try and remember them, because they're all in there somewhere. And when you need them, then they will come out. All these teachings of Ajahn Chah, which he said, I never noted them down. I never tried to remember them. But at the right time and the right place, like seeds which have been planted, and now it was their season to germinate and grow, they grew exactly at the right time. So some of the things which you've heard here on this retreat, huge amounts of information and techniques on how to meditate, you don't need to remember them. You will find that when the right time comes, someone will say, let go, make peace. Someone will say, unconditional mindfulness. Someone will say, still forest pool, animals coming out to play. Some will say, don't be afraid, you deserve this bliss. And you know where all that came from? It came from a retreat, maybe a long time ago. And now, after all this time, the fruit has started to drop. That's how the path works. That's why I have talked a lot, because I've fed you with heaps of conditioning. I've completely and thoroughly brainwashed you. And thank you for letting me, because all of that information will eventually bear fruit, and you too will become a happy one, someone who's tasted the apple, who knows the taste of freedom, who's gone to those huge summits of the mind, and from there can look down on the world and see the whole spread of samsara and understand the beautiful peaks of freedom, of bliss, of enlightenment. What more can you want? So, that is the final talk of this retreat. Maybe, but you never know, things are impermanent. Maybe we can go on for another week. One of the last stories, for those who haven't read my book, concerns one of my friends, who was a monk in the Korean Zen tradition. And on his first retreat, this was in the monastery, it wasn't a 9-day retreat, it was a 60-day retreat. And there was no nice, soft, kind, compassionate, funny Ajahn Brahm. Those Zen teachers were really fierce. And you know what? They walk around with a stick, and if you start nodding, bang, you get it. Ooh, no messing around. And there was no chance of sleeping in the morning, because you slept where you sat. So where you sit there, when it gets to the time of sleeping, you lay down there, and that's where you sleep, so everyone can see what time you get up. And the bell would ring at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you just start 50 minutes sitting meditation, 10 minutes walking, 50 sitting, 10 walking, 50 sitting, 10 walking. When it came to lunch, you had it right there. You couldn't go back out. The only time you could move from your seat was to go and see the teacher. And that wasn't a nice interview. That was an interrogation. I think the US Marines could learn a lot from these Zen masters. So this was really tough. This was not for wimps. This was a tough retreat. And this was just, he was a New Zealander. And he was just like an ordinary little guy. But he decided to go and do this meditation retreat. And he was really trying hard. But any of you who've had any aches and pains or frustrations, that's nothing compared to what he was feeling after one day. And he had another 59 to go. And I think it was about 11 o'clock. They rang the bell. Everything was done by bell, actually, to go to sleep. He'd been meditating there all day. No walks in gardens. Now you can go to the loo very quickly and back again. And that's the only thing. So about 11 o'clock, oh, at last, he can rest. But what happens? Either you're so afraid of getting up on time, or you're so upset, you hardly sleep. And before you know it, ding, ding, morning meditation. So this poor monk, he was getting no respite at all. And after 3 days, his back was in agony. His knees were exploding in pain. And his mind was all over the place. But he was going to force it through. Because there's one thing about Westerners, they're very proud. When he saw all those Korean Asians there, he thought, I'm not going to be beaten by these. He was really a racist, like most people are. But anyway, he tried. After 1 week, he was really had enough. He couldn't stand anything longer, and he wanted to run away. But he looked at all the other monks there, sitting so still, just like it is sometimes with you, having a really hard time to look around, and all these people sitting so still with a smile on their face. It really pisses you off no end. And so he thought, no, I'm going to do it. And so anyway, the first week was passed. He got to 2 weeks. That was like a quarter of the way, 25%. Come on, you can make it. And so every hour was a striving and a struggle, and he got through. And he managed, just managed by the skin of his teeth, to get to the halfway mark, the 30 days. And when you get to a halfway mark, you think, wow, I've done half as much now, I can do the rest. And anyway, if I gave up now, all of that pain, all of that struggle would have been for no use. It would be unfaithful to all I'd been through so far. I'm going to keep on going. But if the first month was long, the second month was much longer. Which is what happens when you get very painful. Time starts to drag. And every hour becomes like 2 hours. And the pain just gets more. Sometimes he thought he was just going to cry with just frustration and pain. But he kept it together, just waiting for the 11 o'clock bell where he can go to sleep. But as soon as he had those few moments of respite, the bell went again. Another day of torture. He got to the 1 week mark. Only 1 week to go. Just like some of you. Only a few hours to go. And then we're free. And as he got to the 1 week mark, it got longer and harder. He was exploding in agony. He thought he would die many times. And it got to 2 days. 1 day. When he woke up on the morning of the final day, he thought, ah, I'm as close to home as you could imagine. It doesn't matter anymore. I'm going to make it. But even though there's only a few hours to go, the pain, as it were, really started to show him what it could do. As if all before that pain was really playing around with him, now it was being serious. Even though there's only a few hours to go, he really thought, he just can't do it. He can't make it. The pain, the agony, the frustration was intense, more than he'd ever realized before. But he gritted his teeth, he clenched his fists, he resolved, I'm not going to get up. And it came at last, at long last, to the last meditation, the last 50 minutes. And if it had been hurting before, now it really showed what pain can do. Those last 50 minutes were like a whole eon. And an eon, for anyone's information, is 37,000 million years. A whole eon of pain was coming. And every now and again, he'd peek at the clock. And he couldn't believe that only 10 minutes had gone past. He was sure it was 10 hours. and he started to think, as you do, is an electric clock. Maybe the batteries are flat. Maybe 10 hours has gone past and those damn batteries are not. What happens if those batteries really run out and the clock stops and the teacher doesn't know it? I'm going to die. But every now and again he reassured himself with what's going to happen after the retreat, just like some of you do. What are you going to do after the retreat? You have a nice evening meal tonight. What are you going to eat tonight? You don't have to have any of this stuff which is prepared. You can choose yourself. Those of you who don't like Italian Western food, you can have some noodles. Can you smell the noodles now? Can you see them? And that's what he was doing, thinking of what's going to do after the retreat. And as soon as he got into a fantasy, bang, the pain would crash into his mind. It was really hard. And this was what he was doing for the last 50 minutes. An eternity of pain and then hope and then frustration and agony again. And at last it happened as it must do. The teacher rang the bell for the end of the retreat. You can imagine the ecstasy he felt. Because whenever you've done something really hard, really, really tough, and you've made it, you get all this joy coming through your body. He'd done something which was very, very difficult to do for a Westerner, first 60-day retreat like that. And he felt so good about himself, so much energy. For those moments, all the pain disappeared. Because he knew it was almost over. A few moments, he'd be back for a nice bath, like a hot bath, all those muscles which are aching. Oh, that would be so nice. And he was smiling when the abbot rang the bell again. "Before you go," he said, "I have an announcement. During the interviews, some of you monks have been telling me how valuable this retreat is and how your meditation has improved enormously. And you've asked me, can we, Master, extend the retreat for another couple of weeks?" "I've considered that and I think that's a jolly good idea." "The announcement is the retreat will last another 2 weeks. Close your eyes and carry on meditating." And this New Zealander, he never felt any pain. Not one bit of pain in his body. Because he felt anger. Raw, burning anger. He just wanted to find out who these damn monks were who made that stupid suggestion and what he was going to do with them. That was what no Buddha should ever think. He was murderous, he was cruel, he was vicious. And as he was thinking all these vicious, murderous, angry, burning thoughts, the bell went again. About 15 minutes had passed, like a second, like a flash. Which is what happens when you're really angry. And the teacher said, "Retreat over, the hot bars are downstairs, the food is down there, enjoy." And this poor monk was thinking, what's going on? Is the retreat finished or not retreat finished? And people saw how confused he was. And one of the senior monks came up to him and said, "The teacher, he does the same thing every year." He said he learned so much about expectations. Whenever you expect something is going to happen, you're asking for trouble. If you really think this retreat is going to end at 3 p.m, you are asking for trouble. Because actually, people in their meditation interviews have been saying how wonderful this retreat is. So sometimes his expectations, he said that story really taught him more than he'd ever learned in the whole 60 days. Just how we create pain with our expectations. And it should finish, it should happen, I should get jhanas, or it should finish, I should get this. All those expectations cause a problem. So please learn about that. You don't know when this retreat is going to end. You don't know when life is going to end. You don't know what's going to happen next. So keep that beautiful mind in the present moment. Make a few plans tentatively, but don't attach them too hard. to see what happens. Be mindful, be still, and make peace with life as it evolves. Tentative plans, but not firm plans. So in a few hours, this retreat might end, then it may not end. But if it does end, we usually come together maybe at 2 o'clock. This is only a maybe. We come together usually at 2 o'clock for the last meditation. And usually sometime around about 2:30, I just interrupt and we do a guided metta meditation, build up the metta. And at the very end, nice bit, I just leave you there and I ring the gong and give you the final blessing. I don't ring the gong and say another 2 days of retreat. I ring the gong, the final blessing, and then the retreat's over. Then you can say whatever you want to each other. So that's usually what happens. So we usually finish just after 3 o'clock, but then you get till 3:30 to clean up. Is that right? Yeah, then we do all the clean up and stuff. But we only do the cleaning up and the packing of the bags at 3 o'clock. Don't pack your bags first. Can you do that? That's what people do. I know some of you are leaving earlier, but some people probably already got their bags packed. They haven't even left yet. Who knows? We might extend this retreat. You have to go to your car and get your bags out again. Come on. So just enjoy the retreat to the very end, because once you pack your bags, as if your mind has left the retreat as well. So remember, the retreat doesn't finish. So you have a saying in Australian: the retreat doesn't finish, or the thing doesn't finish, the concert doesn't end until the fat lady sings. Here, the retreat doesn't end until the fat monk chants. So we don't know what's going to happen. Okay, so that's enough for the talk. Any questions before we finish off this talk? We're going to have a couple of interviews. There's a couple of people I wanted to talk to afterwards. And then if anyone really, 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 really wants an interview, you can sit on the chair outside there, the one which is closest to the interview room, and then you can just come in. Now, first come, first serve. No lists. So see what happens. So if you see that chair empty, which is close to the interview room, then go sit down and get invited in next time. Until 11 o'clock. 11 o'clock we have our meal. But then you can meditate, have a rest, whatever you want to do. And then 2 o'clock, all come together, final meditation together. And then 2:30, we flip into a metta meditation. And then 3 o'clock, a little bit of a blessing. And the retreat maybe finishes. Any questions on that? Comments? Going? Go on. Okay. 2 hours to enlightenment. Before lunch, see if you can fill the mind with food for the heart. The time is right. All the energies are there. The paycheck's in the mail. And the postman might be coming this morning. So make sure you're in. Otherwise the postman calls and there's no one to deliver the check to. So he takes the check away. So see what happens. Okay. That's right, yeah, that's a good point. This is what happened. It's actually what it says in the Chula Vedala Sutta, or Maha Vedala Sutta, because the question was asked, what's the difference between a person in deep meditation and a person who's dead? And that's actually one of the things they say, the body's still warm. And this guy who did this, he told me afterwards that the doctor, one of the reasons why the doctor did not send him to the morgue was just the top half of his body was still warm. The bottom half was as cold as a corpse should be. But the bottom half was still warm. He couldn't explain that at all. Why, when the heart hadn't been pumping for such a long time, there was no brain activity for such a long time, the top half of the body could still keep its warmth. So that's it. That was one of the reasons why I never took him down to the morgue. So, any doctors, you see anyone like that, just check their upper body temperature. They're still warm, then they're okay. That's a good point. Yeah. In deep meditation, you can't have fear. Because fear is always going off to the future. What's going to happen next? Fear is always losing something. And you've lost so much already, you don't care anymore. You've got nothing more to lose. And the same, the happiness is just the base state of deep meditation. That's what meditation is. If you ask a person when they got into deep state, what you're aware of? Are you aware of the breath, or of the body, or of sound, or what you're aware of? They always say the same thing, bliss. Ecstasy. And you just got to inquire, what type of ecstasy? Like what flavour ice cream was it? Chocolate, vanilla, strawberry? Because there's different flavours of bliss. And once you get into, you know, the ice cream business, you can actually know the different flavours. Whether it's double choc or single choc, you know, or triple choc. First jar, second jar, or third jar. Correct, yeah. But happy, yeah. Fear, no. Happiness is still there. And happiness gets really intense. But fear goes. And things stop changing. This is a strange thing about these stages. We know about impermanence, things are supposed to change. But in the jhanas, things don't change for hours. A singleness of perception, which lasts, sort of unchanging. That's why it's just one moment long, as far as you're concerned. But hours go by. Nothing has changed. Just you have this beautiful bliss, constant, one-pointed, unshaking, not moving. That's why you don't know the passage of time. Yeah, that's monks in Thailand. Yeah.
And they have to overcome
the
fear.
Mm.
Why is that?
What is tigers and ghosts? It's just like afraid of losing your body, that's all. Because what can a tiger do to you? Just eat you, that's all. It's a great way of dying, because it means it's a compassionate way of dying. Because number one, you get the merit of feeding a hungry tiger. Number two, your friends and relations don't have to pay for a funeral for you. It's recycled. What a better way can you actually get rid of your body by recycling it to a hungry tiger? So it's a great way of dying. Sure, it's, you know, it's a bit unpleasant for the first few seconds as it's chomping off your head, but that's only a few seconds. And I mean, you've got, it's much more pain and suffering having cancer. My goodness, it's people go and have these operations and these tests and injections and goodness knows. And after the operation, they've got to endure pain for a long time. My goodness, a tiger is much more efficient. It's one bite and you're out. So why are people afraid of tigers? And ghosts. My goodness. Ghosts are just so soft, fluffy little beings. If people are afraid, they've just got a bad PR, that's all, ghosts. They need some PR representative in the world, you know, to actually so people actually appreciate and respect ghosts. You know, we always have this racism before. Some races were just really put down. And we had this speciesism, where some species were just considered to be just the pests. Now the poor ghosts, they're sort of the bottom of the pile at the moment. No one likes ghosts. No wonder they sort of give you a hard time, because they're really depressed that no one likes me. They just come around for a little chat and you go, ah, ghost! And you try and get rid of them. There's one house I went to in Perth. They got these ghosts. And they said that, I don't think they were just Westerners. They tried to get the Catholic priest in to exorcise them. And it made the ghost worse. Because the ghost would say, you don't like me. I'm trying to get rid of me. That's not very compassionate and kind. So the ghost decided to play up, just to show off, you know, just to show you can't exorcise me. It made it much worse. We went there, we said, I let the ghost be, may they be happy and well. They want to stay in here, that's fine. And so the ghost actually calmed down. It was very nice afterwards. So that's not the way to sort of deal with ghosts, being aggressive and trying to get rid of them. Just makes them worse, that's all. So it's like someone trying to get rid of you. Well, that's not fair. So, be kind to ghosts.